Amen. Can we give the Lord a little praise right now as we continue our worship together? Well, good morning. Oh, that was a little weak. Good morning. Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be with you in worship as always. If I have not had the pleasure and the privilege of meeting you. My name is Sue Ann Camfield. I serve as one of our pastors here on staff and a member of our teaching team. And if you are new, maybe just joining us this morning, you may not know this, but for the last few weeks, we have been in a sermon series called Grace in Place of Grace, which we have been walking through the book of John. And our lead pastor, Steve Carter, he has been leading us through that. Hasn't he just been amazing? Yes, I mean, it's been such a great story. Steve is actually at our middle school retreat this weekend. He is leading 100-plus middle schoolers in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And so I texted Grace, our middle school director, and I said, hey, how's it going? Like, how's Steve doing? We're going to check up on him. And I said, give me three words about how he's doing. And she said, oh, my goodness, he's relational. Yes. He's dynamic. Yes. And then how many of you know what the game of knockout is? Because this joke doesn't fly if you don't know what the game of knockout is. Yes? Basketball, right? And she said, also, he's the all-camp knockout tournament loser. That's what he was this morning. And so, Steve, we love you. He'll be watching this at some point. And so if you see him this week, be sure to welcome him back. Thank him for leading our middle school students this weekend. And then tell him this is your favorite sermon of 2025 so far, okay? Can we do that? All right. Well, we have a lot of ground to cover this morning. We have been walking through the book of John, as I said. We are in chapter 4 of the book of John, and we're going to put the text on the screen, but we have been encouraging you as a community to what? Bring your Bibles to church. That's right. So if you have your copy of your scriptures, open them up to John chapter 4. Oh, I like that, hearing the pages turn. And we're going to start with verse 1. We're going to do a little Bible study this morning. Is that okay? All right, let's do it. Now Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John. We learned back in chapter 1 that that's John the Baptist, this forerunner for Jesus, this attractive witness who was pointing people to this new Messiah. And it says, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. And so he left Judea and he went back once more to Galilee. Now he had to go through Samaria. Okay, I want you to just like underline that. Make a mental note. We're going to come back to that. He had to go through Samaria. And so he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples, you see, had gone into town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" For Jews, you see, Jews, they don't associate with Samaritans. All right, let's pause right here. We're going to talk about some context clues, as my children would say, because if we pay attention to our context clues, it's really going to enhance our understanding of the story this morning. And so the first thing I want you to pay attention to, there are two parentheticals. Do you guys know what a parenthetical is in the set of verses? It's when you see parentheses, right? For all my English majors out there, when you see parentheses around a group of text, authors use parentheticals when they want you to know something important about the story, but it kind of interrupts the narrative flow of the story, so they put it in parentheses. And so there's two parentheticals in this group of texts that I want to point out. One, disciples had gone into town to buy food. What does this tell us about Jesus? He's alone. And it's going to become really important to our story to see that he's alone, not with anybody, but with a Samaritan woman. That's parenthetical number one. Parenthetical number two, Jews, do not associate with Samaritans. Now, this makes this part of the story really interesting because it makes Jesus' choice of travel from Judea to Galilee really, really remarkable. We see that Jesus had left Judea, which is where Jerusalem was, and he starts traveling north to Galilee, which was where his hometown was. And in the middle of Judea and Galilee is a town, a region, a city known as Samaria. And in Samaria is a town called Sychar, and it is part of the plot of land where Jacob dug his well. Jacob, the Old Testament patriarch. Jacob, who God renamed Israel. Jacob, the father of the 12 tribes of Israel, who centuries before had conquered this land as part of a military conquest. And he establishes his home for his tribe. Now, I grew up in the country, so this is very common to me, maybe to some of you. Anyone knows, if you have ever had to establish a home on a new plot of land, what's one of the first things you need to do? Water, right? You have to establish a water source. And so Jacob and his friends, they dig a well about 100 to 150 feet deep. Think about that when you're watching the Super Bowl today, about half of the length of a football field. And especially in a dry and a crusty desert, they dig down until they hit a spring of water. A spring of living water. And Jacob, he builds his house on this land, and this well becomes a source of water for his people by which they're going to live. And he passes this down to his son Joseph, and so on and so forth. This area was a very common place for weary travelers to stop and rest. And so verse 4 tells us that to get from Judea to Galilee, Jesus had to go through Samaria. Now, let's talk about this phrase "had to" for a minute, okay? Some of your Bibles may translate this, "it was necessary." Have you ever had a moment in your life where, like, you had to do something? You know what I'm saying? Like, you didn't have to do it, but you had to do it. Maybe it was a job that you had to take, or a conversation that you had to have, or a relationship you had to break off, or a habit you had to give up, or some move you had to make in your life. You came to a decision point where you knew you had to take action. You knew you just had to. But you couldn't explain the why behind it. Like, your friends and your families and your coworkers, they thought you were a little crazy, but, like, you knew in the core of your being, you knew it was necessary. You knew you had to do this thing. Like, you didn't have to, but you had to. Has anyone ever had a moment like that in their lives? I think as Christ followers who are compelled by a spirit that we're going to hear about today that is not of this world, we should have some had-to moments in our lives. You know what I'm saying? Where we don't have to, but because we follow the God of the universe, we had to. This was a moment for Jesus. He had to go through Samaria. He didn't actually have to, but he had to, except there was one problem. What was the problem in our parenthetical? Jews do not associate with Samaritans. Now, there is a long, complicated history between the animosity between Jews and Samaritans. We don't have time to go into it today, but at a very high level, the conflict began at the point in history when the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom of Israel, whose capital was Samaria. And there were Jewish people living there, but one of the number one rules of being Jewish, one of the number one rules of being part of the covenant people of God, is you did not intermix or intermarry with foreigners who had a different culture and followed other gods. And so when the Assyrians conquer Samaria, and over time some of the Jewish people start marrying and intermixing with the Assyrians, and they establish new culture and new bloodline, the Samaritans became these detested half-breeds who were no longer fully Jewish by blood nor by culture. Now, what's more, and again, this is important to our story, if you were a Jewish person, you were considered to be clean. You were clean. If you were a Samaritan person, you were considered to be unclean. And anything you as a Samaritan person touched, anything that you might share with a Jewish person, the thing that you touched became unclean. And then if the Jewish person touched that, they would be unclean also. And so Jews did not associate with Samaritans. And so it would make sense then that a Jewish person who is traveling from Judea to Galilee, when they punch in the address on their GPS and they see there are multiple routes, one of them which is most direct, but the other one that makes them go through some highways and the tolls, they're going to pick the one that may take longer, that may have more cost to it, but at least they didn't have to come in contact with the Samaritans. But what we see, what we know of our Jesus is he makes a living, doesn't he? A way of life, of coming into contact with people that most of us would rather avoid. And so on this day, at this time, Jesus finds it necessary to go through Samaria. Now, verse 6 tells us he's been traveling a long time. It's a long journey. He is tired. It's noon in the desert, and so the sun is beating down on him. He is hot. His friends have left him and gone into town to buy food. He's hungry and alone. By the way, this is a picture of back in John chapter 1 when he tells us the word became flesh and flesh dwelt among us. This is Jesus in the flesh. This is every bit of his humanity. And the poor guy is thirsty. He needs a drink of water. And so Jesus, he sits down at Jacob's well, and who does he see coming towards him but a Samaritan? And not only any Samaritan, but a Samaritan woman. And if Jewish people detested Samaritans, they had a special disdain in their heart for Samaritan women because they were thought to be perpetually unclean. And both Jesus and the Samaritan woman would have been well aware of this, which makes the conversation that's about to unfold, the conversation that Jesus initiates, the conversation that is the longest recorded conversation between two individuals in all of Scripture, it makes this conversation truly remarkable. Jesus, the pure Jewish rabbi, talking to the unclean Samaritan woman in the middle of the day, in public, alone, scandalous, and he asks her for a drink. And in this scenario, guess who has something from which he can drink? And guess who does not? The Samaritan woman has the vessel. Have you ever been out on a sweaty soccer field or exercising and like someone forgets their water bottle and they come up and they're like, dude, can I just have like a sip of your water? You're like, gross, all right, gross. That's what have been happening here. And so as you can imagine, the woman is stunned. She's incredulous. And so she says to Jesus, hey buddy, read your context clues. How can you be asking me for a drink? And then Jesus does what he often does when he's inviting people into a new way of life. He answers her question by confusing the heck out of her. Let's see, verse 10. Let's continue the story. Jesus answered, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asked you for a drink, you would have asked him. You would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank for it himself, and did also his sons and his livestock? The woman said to him, Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become what? In them. Okay, I want you to notice that. In them, a spring of water welling up to eternal life. And then the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty, so I don't have to keep coming back to this well time and time again every single day to get more water." All right, let's talk about water for a minute. Can we do that? Water here has a double entendre. Okay, on one side, it's physical. The woman has come talking about physical water, and Jesus has come asking for a physical drink of water. We know that water meets a very basic human need. Humans can't live longer than 3 days without some water. It's for our survival. And anyone who has ever been thirsty, has anyone in here ever been thirsty? You know, right? It would be ridiculous to think you can drink water one time and then never come back in and need another drink. We wouldn't survive. And so being thirsty is part of our perpetual human experience. God created us. He created our physical bodies to thirst. So that's meaning number one. The second meaning of water here is spiritual. Water is used as a metaphor time and again throughout the scriptures to refer to the living water. You heard Aaron talk about this already. The living water that is equivalent to the power and presence and reality of a good and gracious God. The prophet Isaiah promises God's people that they will never hunger nor thirst, nor will the desert heat or the sun beat down on them. For he who has compassion on them will guide them and lead them beside springs of what? Living water. All right, the other thing that's important about this is the word living. We can't leave that part out because it's everything in here. Have you ever walked beside a stream of living water? Have you ever watched a water flow over rocks and jump and just see it bubbling of life and excitement? My family and I, anytime we go on vacation, we find places that have bubbling streams of living water and we just sit beside them and hang out. Why? Because there is something about living water that tells us that there is something living within it. We like to be around it. Now, let me ask you this. Have you ever been walking somewhere, say like one of our forest preserves, and you're walking on the path and you come around a corner and all of a sudden you come to this stagnant place of water? It's just like green and algae and there's like lily ponds on it. And what happens? The smell just hits you in the face because it's stagnant. There's nothing alive in it. And so let me ask you a question. If you were walking beside two streams and you had the choice of drinking living water, this one on the right, and drinking something from the water on the left, which one do you choose? It's obvious, right? It's obvious. And yet so often what we do in our own lives when we are faced with this choice to drink from the perpetually good, never-ending water of a good and gracious Father, and drinking from the stagnant, smelly water of a pond that we know is going to make us sick, what do? We choose poorly. Why do we do that? I remember one January, I was with my kids and my husband, and I did one of those things that you try to do as a good parent, right? I thought I was being really intentional with my kids, and so I call a family meeting. Have any of you ever called a family meeting with, like, teenagers? Sit around your table, does that ever go well? No, okay, well, that's how this story is going to end, but I'm eternally optimistic, and so I gather my family around the table, and I say, you guys, we're going to talk about what we want from our lives this year, what we desire. We're going to talk about our hopes and our dreams and our goals. We're going to talk about what character traits we want to develop. We're going to talk about how we want to be different people at the end of this year than when we began. And I get them all around the table, and then I had to step away from the table for a few minutes. I probably ran upstairs to throw on a sweatshirt or put on a pair of socks or something. And I come back down, and they're all getting up from the table. I'm like, I wasn't even gone for like 2 minutes. What are you doing? And they're like, no, we got it. We figured it out. And I was like, what do you mean you figured it out? My daughter Sadie's the first one. She's like, yep, Mom, we got this. We know what we're doing. And I was like, you didn't answer one of my questions. Like, you didn't write one thing down. And my son is like, yep, Mom, we got it. And then my husband, he'll do anything to get out of a family meeting, right? My husband is like, yeah, we got it. And I was like, all right, what are you going to do? And Sadie's like, we're going to drink more water. I'm like, really? For the whole year, that's the thing that you came up with? You're going to drink more water? Here's the thing. They're not wrong. They're not wrong. Drinking water is a good thing. I just wonder how often in our spiritual lives, we know we need to drink more water, but we don't take the time to examine our water sources. We don't take the time to ask ourselves what we are drinking from. And so instead, we're like, done, I'm going to drink more water. Except what happens when we drink more water from the wrong places? What happens to our lives? It doesn't go so well for us, does it? God knows this. It's been true of his people throughout the history of time. In the book of Jeremiah, God says this, my people have committed two sins. This is going to make you feel like you're in good company. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and they have dug their own cisterns. Broken cisterns that, guess what, cannot even hold water. Now, in an ancient time, cisterns were often built of mud and clay, and they were receptacles that people would use to catch rainwater. And they worked as water sources, but the problem with cisterns is no matter how well they were made, no matter who built them, they were not indestructible. They were not everlasting. They would eventually, every single one of them, they would crack and they would break. And my friends, this morning, I would imagine if you are like me, you've got a couple cisterns in your life. We do. We all have some cisterns in our lives. Maybe one of them that we're trying to draw water from is our relationships. Maybe it's our friendships. Maybe it's from our coworkers. Maybe it's a dating relationship. Maybe it's our marriage or our kids. We love these people. And they're so beautiful and they're so kind and they're good, so we keep drinking more water. Or maybe it's toxic relationships that aren't good for us, but for some reason we keep going back and we keep drinking more water because we want our thirst to be quenched. We want our desires to be met. But no matter how much water we drink, we're like, golly, I don't know, I'm still thirsty. Maybe it's our job. Maybe it's our achievements. Maybe it's our status. Maybe it's our social media profile. We think, oh my gosh, if I could just get this influence. I've worked so hard. I've worked so hard to make this team or to get into this college or to get this job or this position or this paycheck. I've worked so hard, and actually some of my needs are actually being met. Some of this actually feels pretty good. So I'm just going to keep drinking more water from this well, from this cistern. But after a while, we're like Tom Brady, who won 7 Super Bowls. And someone asks him how he's doing, and he's kind of like, you know what, my belly is full. I should feel satisfied. But guess what? I'm still thirsty. Maybe it's a habit. Maybe it's an addiction. Maybe it's our image. Maybe it's our health. Maybe it's a political leader or ideology. But we keep going back to drink more and more water, and yet our throats, they just keep getting dry. And even the good cisterns, they just keep on cracking. And the God of the universe comes, and he sits with us at the side of the well. And he says, listen. You're thirsty because I have created you to thirst. You long because I have created you to long. You desire because I have created you to desire. But what I have created you to desire is me. Is me, and I am the only cistern, the only thing in your life that can satisfy the longings in your soul. I am the only thing in life that will not crack or fail. And this is what Jesus is trying to tell the woman at the well. He's like, listen, but she's not convinced. She's just not quite there yet. And so Jesus does what he often does when he wants to get our full attention. He leans in. He gets intimate. He gets personal with her, and he starts telling her about her story. He says this, verse 16. He told her, "Go and call your husband." Go ahead, go call him. And then come back. And she says, "I have no husband." And Jesus says to her, "You are right. I know. You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands. And the man now that you have is not your husband. What you have said is quite true." "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is Jerusalem." Now, I've always been taught to look at this woman a certain way. I've always been taught to look at this woman as someone who is covered in shame. A woman with a shady past, with a promiscuous present, a woman who has made numerous bad choices and as a result is reaping the consequences of her sin. And I mean, there's some evidence for this. In a culture where women traditionally drew water communally, it was a social event, and they would do it either in the early morning or in the late day to avoid the heat, this woman was here at noon, and she was alone. Why could that be? I mean, five failed marriages? That's hard, no matter what culture. That seems a lot. Cohabitating in an ancient culture, that's pretty scandalous. It's actually akin to being a prostitute. And I've made some assumptions about this woman, but as I've learned a little bit more about her story, I've learned to be more empathetic to her. More curious, like our good friend Ted Lasso says, than judgmental. The truth is, we don't know why she had five husbands. Was she widowed? Was she divorced? She lived in a culture where women didn't have any right to pursue a divorce. The man had to initiate that, and he could do it for just about any reason he wanted. And so what was the reason? Was she infertile? Did she have a sharp tongue? Was she, in fact, an adulteress? Was the man she was living with now, was he just a casual relationship? Or was he actually the only way that she, a woman, could be protected and find provision in an ancient culture? The truth is, we just don't know. We can speculate all day long, just like today, we can speculate all day long about people's whose lives we don't have all the details of, but that's not what Jesus does. And so the truth is, we just don't know the intimate details of her story, but what we do know, that as Jesus starts to lean in, as he starts to say, I know you, I know your story, he starts to reveal some very things about her personal life, we see a shift in this woman. She goes from thinking that Jesus is just an ordinary Jewish man who needs a drink to thinking, well, maybe he's a prophet. Maybe there's something to him. Maybe he's actually greater than Jacob, the prophet that we look up to as Samaritan people. Maybe Jesus is greater than him. And so she does what many of us so often do when we start to feel uncomfortable in a conversation. It's like, ooh, just got too personal. I'm feeling a little vulnerable. What do? We deflect. We change the subject. And so that's exactly what she does here. And she says, okay. She goes, but our ancestors, they worshiped on this mountain. Now, they were sitting in the shadows of Mount Gerizim. It was the mountain in which, after the Sumerians were conquered by the Assyrians, they established a new place to worship God. And so they are sitting in the shadows of this mountain. And she says, this is where the Samaritans say we worship. But you Jews claim the place we must worship is in the temple in Jerusalem. And so which is it? This was one of the very deeply rooted conflicts between Jewish people and Samaritans. And she's like, all right, smarty pants, like, which is it? Which place is the true place where we worship God? Which well do I drink from? Where does the presence of God actually dwell? And we see Jesus' answer in verse 21. "Woman, soft, kind," I imagine him here, "woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans, you worship what you do not know, and we worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming, and now has come, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is Spirit, and his worshipers must worship in the Spirit and in the truth." What? Right? What's happening here? You know, Jesus says to her, you don't understand. You don't get it. My presence cannot be contained by geography. That is not how this works, because it's not about where you worship. It's not about where you worship. It's about who you worship and how you are going to worship. It's about who. Who is the source of your living water? Where does it come from? And it's about how I'm going to worship in God's Spirit, which he has given us, and in his truth, which he has also given us. In other words, Jesus says, "I came to blow all your categories, to shift all your paradigms. I came to give you a new source of water because it's forever changed. Your rituals and your rules and your man-made traditions and your cultural boundaries and your ethnic prejudices, your gender biases, your cisterns and your wells and your mountains and your temples, guess what? None of them can hold water. Not one. None of them are sufficient. None of them are sufficient." And he says, that's why it was necessary. That's why I had to do it. That's why I had to come here and do for you what you could not do for yourself. Because not only will you always be tempted to go to that place to quench your thirst from a broken cistern, but guess what? You are a broken cistern too. And so I had to come here. It was necessary. I had to be tired and thirsty at the side of this well so I could be naked and broken as I hung on a cross. And do you know, my brothers and sisters, do you know what I seek from you in return? Do you know, Jesus says, what I desire? To trust me. To trust me to quench your thirst. To allow me to satisfy the deepest longings of your soul, to put me above every relationship, every achievement, every priority in your life, for me to be deeper than any well and higher than any mountain, to exalt me, to worship me, to find me worthy of every single drop of water in your life. And the only way you can do that is through the power of my Holy Spirit that I have given you, that will come to you, my very presence that bubbles and churns and brings life and flows in you and out of you and gives you power to do what you cannot do for yourself, to drink from the right well. I give you my Spirit. And he says then, and I root you in my truth. Truth, the person of Jesus Christ. He says, what I desire from you is for you to become so thirsty that you live in this story, that you live in the truth of who I am, because my friends, you do not worship on a mountain you do not know. The person of Jesus Christ is revealed to us in these pages, and God says, I just want your heart. I just want who you are. And the woman, she hears this, and we see another shift in her, because she goes from believing that Jesus was just an ordinary Jewish man to believing he was a prophet to believing that he was who he said he was. In fact, he was the Messiah. Verse 25, the woman says, "I know the Messiah. I know he's coming. And when he comes, he will explain everything to us." And Jesus looks her dead in the eye, and he says, it's me. I, the one who am speaking to you, I am he. Worship. What does God desire from us? What does he ask from us? True worship. And one of our values here at Christ Church is we delight in that kind of authentic worship. Worship that is empowered in the Spirit, that is rooted in the truth, the person of Jesus Christ, not just here on Sundays when we come to sing songs, but every day in our life when we leave this place, everywhere we go, that we would exalt the living God, that we would put him above everything else in our lives, that we would acknowledge him as the only source of living water, and that we would enjoy the water then that he gives us, his limitless presence that gives us pleasure and it gives us purpose. This, my friends, is the kind of worship that God seeks from us, and this kind of worship that we as a church, it's what we want to be about. It's what we want to call you into. It's what we want to do in genuine community together. And so my friends here, my worship team, aren't they amazing? Our worship team, yeah. We're going to close this in a song, and it's just called Worthy. And that word worthy, it actually means to worship. And as we start this off, I just want you to think of a place in your life. Where are you tired and thirsty? Where are you drinking water from the wrong place, but you just keep going back again and again and again? What's a mountain you've made holy? And God is like, you don't understand, my presence is not there. Where maybe do you feel unworthy in your life? Where are you at that maybe you've been believing Jesus is just a Jewish man or a prophet, and now today is the day where you think, he's the Messiah. He's the source of living water. And so this first part of the song, we're just going to acknowledge that. We're going to worship the Lord. And the first part, Kim, I'm going to ask you to actually, can you sing this first part for us? You don't have to sing it. Let's just hear, sing. Let's know what's coming here, Kim.
It's really easy. It just Worthy is your name, Jesus. You deserve the praise. Worthy is your name.
Can you all do that together? All right, we can do that. All right, now I'm going to ask you to do a second thing. We get to the part of the song, I think it's called The Bridge. And it says this, I won't ask you to sing this part, Kim. It says this, be exalted now in the heavens, as your glory fills this place. And so what I want you to do is take that place where you feel tired and thirsty and just say, Lord, you deserve all the praise. Your name is worthy. And then what I want you to do when we get to this exalt part, I want you to come out of your shoes. I want you to come out of everything in your being, even those of you who are up in that other part of the church up there, right? That second church up there, we see you. I want you to do it too, all right? And I just want you to think of all those broken cisterns in your life and where you need to exalt God above all of them and trust him to let his living water flow. Just watch all those things break as we praise the one who is worthy of all our praise. Can we do that together, church? Can we do some authentic worship right now? All right, let's rise to our feet. Let's give God all the praise.